Hey everyone, thanks for listening to my podcasts here on the Hullerstubber feed. Do spread the word to other people if you think they might enjoy them. Do listen to some more if you think you might enjoy them, but do enjoy this one. I am shortly going to be on tour with my new stand-up show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Head to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all those dates. Some of them are sold out, some of them have hardly sold anything. It would really help me if you bought tickets to the ones that aren't sold out. Either way, as soon as you can. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. It's about cancer and testicles. One of them's not funny, but one of them's really funny, and it kind of cancels out the unfunniness. I'd say just on average, slightly more funny. So I hope you'll come along. If not, keep enjoying the podcast. We'll be back in September at the Leicester Square Theatre with more live podcasts. Maybe a few Edinburgh ones before then. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this stupid podcast you've chosen to listen to.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Welcome to another Rahalastapa book club. My guest this week is Georgia Pritchett, and she has written a book called My Mess is a Bit of a Life. I think she's made a mistake on the front cover. Hello, Georgia. How are you doing?
Hello. I'm very well. Thank you.
Good. It's lovely to see you. We did cross paths a few times in our lives.
Yes.
Largely at the Radio Light Entertainment Corridor in about 1992 or 1993.
Yeah.
But when did you start?
1991, yeah.
Yeah. Well, for people who aren't aware of you, Georgia, which can hardly be anyone, how would you describe yourself?
Oh, gosh. a puny human small, curly hair, writer, confused human. Pile of meat.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty much what the book's about. That's good. And you've written on some amazing projects, including High Heels and Low Lives, which is my favourite one, which you briefly mentioned in the book, but also things like Succession and Veep. You're doing okay. You're doing all right.
Thank you.
As a writer, so congratulations
Thank
on
you.
Your success. And do you want to tell us about the book and, how did it come about? How would you describe your book?
I mean, yes, that's an excellent question. I think, people have said, why did I decide to write it? And my only answer is a terrible lapse in judgment or lockdown madness. Because I think, you know, what I love about being a scriptwriter is that you literally put words in other people's mouths and you're completely anonymous. So to write something so personal and so direct is in many ways horrifying and possibly a terrible error. But I after all these years, I suddenly thought maybe it's time for a bit of brutal honesty. And
it is a very honest book. So the book starts with you being advised to write everything down by your therapist. Is that generally what happened, or is that a conceit to get you into this?
No, it's genuinely what happened. And I was kind of at crisis point. And the title is actually also true, that I went to the doctors and meant to say my life is a bit of a mess and said my mess is a bit of a life. And that seemed more true. And yeah, I think, you know, I love words. I'm all about the words. I'm a writer. It's my thing. But suddenly, maybe it's from being a comedy writer, which, as you know, really means you have to be very emotionally unevolved and dysfunctional and weird. But I just I just couldn't find the words to describe what was going on. You know, if I couldn't sort of make a joke out of it, I couldn't think how to communicate it. So this therapist said, you should write it down. I thought, yeah, I'm definitely not going to do that. I started thinking I'll get to a couple of pages and that'll be it. But I sort of became fascinated by the experience of writing this sort of very personal thing after hiding in plain sight for so long.
Well, it is terrific, and it's an interesting way of writing, because you're obviously, it's like a little fractured bits of memory almost of the chapters. Some things are just like a couple of lines, some of the chapters, if we call them chapters, are a couple of lines. Some of them are a page or two pages, but they're just little memories throughout your life. So it's an autobiography of a kind, but whilst taking us through, I mean, some traumatic and some. I mean, it's a very funny book, though. It's also there's moments that are very, very upsetting and very and traumatic things for you, that you personally have gone through. But it's largely like darkly funny, right?
Yes. It's sort of, the plus point is it's very short. It's basically a lengthy tweet. And I think, it's the sort of short chapters, if they even qualify as chapters, is not so much a sort of literary choice as just kind of embracing my limitations as a writer. And I think, having been a script writer for so long, my brain just sees things in terms of scenes. So it's essentially just lots of scenes from my life. To your point, I got really interested in how memory works. And while I was writing it, I read this thing that we only ever remember anything once. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah, apparently the way our brains work is that we remember everything once, and then every time after that we remembering it.
Right.
So in a way, we're all constantly kind of writing our own memoirs and sort of honing our life story and our origin stories. So, and I just, when I was writing it, I wanted to sort of stay true to the kind of impressionistic nature of memory and not sort of imbue my childhood self with any kind of hindsight or adult wisdom, such as it is. So, it was fun to kind of remember that sort of feeling where you witness things or experience things, but you don't really get the full meaning or see the big picture.
Yeah, no, that's definitely really, I love that about it. And I love the fact that it is, you know, our memories of our own lives are fractured in this way, and that you do, you know, you tend to recall those moments, and there's obviously vast swathes of stuff in between that you might know what happened, or you might have an idea of what happened, but it is, when you think back to your childhood, especially, and the childhood stuff is great, because I think, well, it's a great sort of, you know, you're it's a great example of what a writer is, I think, and certainly what a comedy writer is, in that your observations are, that even that you're having as a child, are very, the things you're picking out to remember and the things that you're observing are very much from a comedy writer's point of view. But also the point of the book, I suppose, is that you have this, you know, anxiety about life, which I think's under, you know, I obviously I empathize with a lot of this as a writer myself, in sort of being bewildered in the face of life.
Yes.
But it seems like the correct response. I mean, when you're a child, especially, because you don't know the full facts. But even so, even as you become an adult, if you you're properly examining life, it's ridiculous and insane. And and you should be anxious.
Yes, yes, exactly.
which you are. But you managed to find the funny stuff out. And because it's memories of memories, maybe, do you think, because the thing early on that you think, well, that can't really have happened, Georgia, is when your dad comes to pick you up from nursery and says he's forgotten your name.
Yes.
He might have said that, right? But he did. He can't have forgotten your name, really.
He really did. This is all absolutely true. He absolutely did. And when he was trying to remember my name, the best he could come up with was Emily's friend. And for a while I did sort of think about writing the book, because I'm shy and didn't want to sort of come out with all this stuff. I did think about writing the book under the name Emily S. Friend as a pseudonym.
It's funny, but it's sort of heartbreaking. And I mean, it's a real sort of, you get a real view of this. You're sort of happy enough, right? But you're a person who likes to be sort of, the thing on the back is the idea you went to a party and you're happy because you had cake, but you didn't join in any of the party games.
Yes.
Which, again, I can really empathise with.
Yeah.
Which I think maybe a lot of comedians can.
Yeah. No, I think absolutely. I mean, I think I just come from a long line of baffled, worried people. So it's not a sort of misery memoir. I was just sort of, as you say, appropriately overwhelmed and bewildered by the strangeness of life.
But they're just lovely. I think the things that, the stories that come out, and it's having an imaginary friend who found you tiresome, I think that's really interesting. I really love the story about the woodwork teacher at your school had a car he wanted to get rid of, but then just sawed it up and threw it in the bin bit by bit. And I think, again, like someone to remember that and to understand, to have the perspective to see why that's funny as well.
Yeah.
So that sort of nascent comedy writer in you coming through it's a really weird book to get into, because you feel a little bit sad but you're laughing, and you feel a bit sorry for you in a way, but while still sort of backing you. So it's a really interesting way of getting into something, and again, I think like most good things, it takes a little while to really tune into the wavelength of it, but once you're into the wavelength of it, I think it's a very, very satisfying book, I think, to read, because as you went into the more personal details of your adult life, was that harder to talk about than the childhood stuff, or was it, once you'd got going, did you think I'm going to be open about everything?
It was hard, because I think two things. I don't know if you have this, but if you're a comedy writer, I think it's easy to think that your job is to be happy, and so admitting to anything else feels dangerous and scary, I think it's, I mean, friends who've known me all my life have sort of told me they've only known like 80% of what's in the book. So I've always been a very private person, and coming from a sort of classic middle class English family where we never talk about personal things, I was very worried about what my family would say. But of course, what's happened is we've never talked about it, so it's worked out really well. I haven't had to have any difficult conversations. So
But it is interesting. I think, and as a stand-up comedian, I'm sort of a foot in both camps, because obviously I'm a writer, but also I've done some performing, and it's a slightly different world, isn't it? And you don't do your own audio book, for example, so you don't feel comfortable as a performer, exactly, no, necessarily, which it does make things a little bit different. But I think it is, you are filled with those those feelings. And I think the thing that the inner critic that you have, that you talk about, this sort of Muppet, the old guys in the Muppets.
Yes.
Statler and Waldorf. You have basically an inner monologue criticizing everything you're doing.
Yes.
As you go through. Which, you know, I think we all do.
Yeah.
Although, how are they reacting to you being? Are they managing to criticize Succession and Veep? They must find it difficult to now have a go at you, those inner critics.
I think they can still manage it. And also, I think, you know, as you know, with comedy, what's sort of exciting and terrifying about comedy is people feel so strongly about it, don't they? They don't kind of didn't mind it. They always either love it or hate it. And so, as well as my inner critics, I've had plenty of outer critics who've written terrible reviews of every single thing I've ever written. So it's good to know that there are people out there who just hate everything you've ever done. It's very grounding.
But that's the thing. I think people on Twitter feel the need to tell you, and you kind of go, you're not going to say anything worse than I've said to myself. So they're not covering it. So that, I think that, you know, that's always going to be a part of it, except that there are a few creative people, I think, who are basically believe that they're always right and that nothing they can do is wrong and that they're perfect. But that they're, and usually they're either the greatest or the worst performers or writers of all time. I find it, you know, it is an interesting, if you just took the autobiography of as a writer, I think that without the personal side of it, if you looked at it, they're looking at the professional side of it, I think it's kind of interesting. You sort of made different choices than I did. And I think your way was the best way to do it. So like, I think like by being a writer, the job is I was, you know, a writer comedian, so I was often offered work and think, well, will I take this job? Because, well, how will that affect the view of people as me as a comedian? So I'd often turn things down. But I think actually it's the absolute right thing. And the only weird thing you can do really as a writer is to take the work when it comes up.
Yeah.
So there's jobs you worked on that, you know, compared to Succession and Veep, seem like on the other side of the coin. But you'll have learned so much doing those shows,
yes,
and by taking everything. And what I really like about it is that there's a lot of defense of because you've worked in so many different things. You worked on The Real McCoy and The Lenny Henry Show, which again, you talk about not being a natural fit, but because you're a woman, you're a minority, so they felt you fitted in. But I think your defense of those shows is a defense of Lenny Henry is the way he's viewed and the way women writers are viewed, I think is really interesting. But which we might talk about again in a second. But you worked on things like the Spice Girls movie,
yes,
which you know some people might have said no to, but I think again by doing that, you've got an amazing story in the book about it for a start. But I presume you learn more on a job like that, and also you end up meeting people who you know give you work further down the line.
Yes,
so
yeah. That's nice of you to say, because I think there are times when you're just saying yes to everything and whoring yourself around when you just feel so dirty and used. But I think it does hopefully add up to sort of, you do learn things, you know, with every.
Well, I think that's what I think. You see the progression of it, and you kind of think, as a writer, I just thought, maybe if I'd done some of those things that I did, you know, I would have met someone, or I'd have been a little bit out of my own bubble, and you're in something else. And you learn, by writing. I think you sort of talk about that yourself, you know.
Yeah.
But you learn by writing on those things.
Yeah.
And, you know, and most of them, and if something doesn't work out, most people don't, you know, no one remembers High Heels and Low Lives, do they? No one remembers that. You can comfortably walk down the street and say, I wrote that. No one knows either way whether it was good or bad.
Exactly.
Was it good or bad, George?
There were some excellent moments in it.
That you wrote. But yeah, but again, and you were, bizarrely, even though you're starting in the early 90s, you were sort of the only woman in the room for most of your career. So like, it's only in recent jobs and going to America and working on these American shows that you found yourself in writers' rooms with another woman.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of an astonishing thing to, even for me, really, to, I mean, you know, I think about it and go, yes, that's true. I'm looking at Weekending, and there was, you know, there was maybe two female writers on it. And the other one you mentioned in the book is Debbie Barham, who very sadly died very young.
Yeah.
You know, do you think things are improving? Is it going to, from now on,
I really hope so. I mean, I didn't know anything different, and I loved all the men I worked with. So, I did sort of think, where are all the other women? And it wasn't for 25 years until I wrote with another woman.
That's just sort of insane, though.
Yeah, and I was shocked, actually, at how thrilling that was. I kind of thought, oh, I'm fine, it's all right. But there's something about sort of sitting opposite people who kind of look a bit like you and dress a bit like you and have similar life experiences that is incredibly exciting and must be how it is to be a white man every minute of every day when you walk in any room or turn on the TV. And you know, hopefully things are changing now. I mean, I would say, you know, there's writer performers, you know, have like Michaela Cole and Phoebe Waller-Bridge and Sharon Horgan have written some fantastic shows, although that's come from a place where they've thought, I'm not being written good enough roles. So they've kind of written them themselves. But I think that's making a difference. But I would, you know, it's funny, isn't it? I think when you're in comedy, I try not to criticize other comedies, because even if I don't find them funny, I'm glad they exist and that other people find them funny. And, you know, it's hard making people laugh. So I'm, you know, hats off to anyone doing it.
Yeah.
But I do sort of feel it makes me a bit sad when I see something like Mrs. Brown's Boys, because I think that's a man in a dress pretending to be a woman. And wouldn't it be great if there was a mainstream sitcom that had gone on for that long that just was a woman in the lead rather than a man pretending to be a woman in the lead? You know, it feels like in 2022 that feels a bit of a shame.
It does. I mean, it would be okay if there were some other ones, you know, if there were other ones and this was one and
yes,
there were five other shows, you know, it's exactly that it is. I just sort of think that it's sort of insane that, you know, you exactly what you're saying. You get five university educated white men, they're not going to give you that much different stuff. It is. I mean, I've very rarely been in writers' rooms. I did a writers' room and I actually got kicked off it in the end. Because now it's prejudice against white men, and also I wasn't very good. But that's not the point. But by having some different experience, you know, the different experiences, you would think that's going to make this sitcom or whatever, especially a sitcom, there's lots of characters.
Yeah.
If you know, you can, obviously a writer can put themselves in the minds of different people, but it would be helpful just go, oh yeah. I love that story in Veep, and that you've suffered from sort of anxiety nosebleeds, and then that becomes this big moment in
yes,
Veep, that nobody else would have thought of that moment other than someone it's happened to. So if you get enough experience, you'll find the perfect thing to do.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years, like a chatbot maybe your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Yeah. I love this. I mean, I love the story about you and Ronnie Corbett exchanging scripts and money in a lay-by.
Yes.
Which again, just doesn't sound like it could be true. So tell us about that and tell me if that is.
That's completely true. Yes, I was. my phone rang and this voice said it's Ronnie Corbett, and I was working, you know, on Weekending Spit Image, working with quite a few impressionists, so just assumed it was a wind-up, but it was actually Ronnie asking me to write some jokes, and this was back in the days of faxes, but of course because I was writing on Weekending and getting £8 a joke, I didn't have a fax, so I was living in Peckham and he was living in Croydon, so we agreed to meet in Streatham in a lay-by, and I drove up in my very banged-up Mini and he drove up in this incredible Bentley, and we sort of both got out of our cars and I handed him a brown envelope full of jokes and he handed me a brown envelope full of cash, and it was very gangster, or as close to gangster as I'm ever going to get.
But with Ronnie Corbett in there, it's so amazing to think that it's lovely that he did that. Yeah. That he did that himself, and that he came out. I mean, if it had been any of the other entertainers in the world, you might have been in trouble. But luckily, it was Ronnie.
Exactly.
Corbett, so you were fine. Oh dear, yeah, that was great. But also like this, it's sort of because you're obviously. They're obviously going through troubles and are troubled, and you've got some reasons to be unhappy. And I have to say, as with Rachel Paris's book, there's a very moving story about miscarriage in this book as well. But lots of things going on. But your career is sort of going so well in a way. Was that not important to you, or was writing it down, did it make you think actually life is pretty good, because there's lots of great things also going on in your personal life, or did you get a sense, because you're so successful as a writer?
I don't think you ever feel successful, do you? You always feel, oh, I could, you know, I want to be better, or I could be better, sure. Should be better. But I think it definitely helped, actually. I think it's very easy when you're in the middle of the sort of chaos of life to give yourself a hard time and think, I should be a better person, writer, partner, mother. But there's something about writing it down, maybe a bit like, you know, writing a script where you almost treat yourself as a character. And I always feel very fondly towards characters I write. So I found a bit of a shred of compassion for myself in my cold black heart. But also, as you say, I think, you know, it's funny, there's this sort of weird axis where as my career started to go better, having really sort of struggled, and there was a long trudge across a tundra in many ways of writing for some terrible shows with awful people and having difficult experiences. But just as that sort of took off, my sort of I became much more sort of troubled, and a lot of things happened in a row that I had trouble coping with. So just as it kind of got really good, I was really struggling. And so actually sort of writing it down, it was helpful to kind of think, oh, there's, you know, that was a great experience I wasn't expecting to have. I think I say in the book there's this moment where everything's pretty terrible, but I have to go to America and actually to the White House, and I have to get a visa. And on my visa, it says something like, an alien with extraordinary ability. And I just think at the time I was too sort of, I was struggling too much to appreciate it. But now I think, oh, that's pretty cool. Like if someone had said to me when I was 11, when you grow up, you're going to be an alien with extraordinary ability, I would have been absolutely thrilled. So,
yes. Well, and it is sort of a description of a comedy writer as well.
Yes.
That's so lovely. And you're working with Michelle Obama when you were doing, so, and riffing with Michelle Obama. So, I mean, that's, you know, that's pretty extraordinary. Yeah. And, you know, especially when you think of Weekending, you know, like, and you were there the same time as me, and it was, you know, it was very difficult to spot the people who were just in there so they could get out of the cottage.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And who didn't have a house to live in. From the people who would go on to be Hollywood superstars or write for Hollywood superstars.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's sort of a very strange thing when you look back at it and think of, you know, both the talent in that room and the eccentrics in that room.
Yeah.
And it's a Venn diagram where most people are both, or the successful people are both. But I think as a biography, an autobiography of a writer, this somehow completely nails it without this little fractured look at things as you go.
It
almost less is more. It's a beautifully written and it's just, it's very funny.
I think the self-loathing outweighs the name dropping, I hope. But
the name drop, but also because, you know, you get an idea of who you are, and you know, I think the name dropping is still it's sort of extraordinary that your journey would take to the same place as Michelle Obama's journey for perfectly justifiable reasons.
Yes.
And that you would have that power to be writing.
I think that what sort of always been so true as I've got older is realizing, you know, particularly when working on The Thick of It and Veep, you know, both sort of politicians in this country, and then when I was at the White House, everyone saying, oh my God, it's so true to life. And you sort of thinking, oh shit, I thought it was a massive exaggeration. But I think what's been great is just realizing that always life is a better joke writer than I or you or anyone could ever be. And, you know, Veep, we sort of had this kind of awful, ruthless, lying, venal monster of a president, female, which obviously could never happen, we realize now, but of a president. And then Trump got in, and just overnight, you know, our fictional president had a sense of shame, and overnight that suddenly seemed so twee and old-fashioned that we had to stop making Veeps. Not the worst thing that Trump's done, but it was so interesting then, you know, we stopped making Veep, and then Trump had his presidency, and I was actually in the States for the last election when Rudy Giuliani gave that press conference in front of Four Seasons Total Landscaping. Yeah. And it was just like, I would never have thought of that joke in a million. That is so brilliant. Between a pawn shop and a whatever the other thing was, it was just perfection. And you just realize always that truth is going to be better at drama and at comedy than we could ever be.
Well, I mean, maybe, but you know, the incredible shows nonetheless. And I listened on audiobook, which you did not, as we said, you did not do the audiobook yourself, Catherine Parkinson, which is I think a pretty good replacement. You're not going to have yourself. I always like to hear the author doing the audiobook because I think, you know, they know the text, but obviously it's not always going to happen.
Yeah.
Was it ever an option that you were going to do it yourself? Or
never. I mean, no one wants to listen to my monotonous, reedy voice banging on. And I was really so excited that Catherine did it. She did a great job.
Yeah, she really. I mean, she really did do a very. I mean, it's difficult because you know, obviously, someone might miss the tone of it entirely, or or miss the jokes. Yeah. And she I mean, she's obviously a fantastic actor, yeah. And that's not so good at Taskmaster, it's a lovely reading. It was enjoyable. But I don't know. I mean, I hope, you know, people are listening to you talk for an hour now. It's not much longer than that.
Yeah, well, true.
Were you writing this down? And then I noticed you thanked Joe Unwin for persuading you to put it in the books. Were you not thinking of publishing it, or how did the actual publication come about?
Yeah, I mean, that I really thought it would never happen and then never go out. And Joe Unwin, somewhere on the spectrum of sort of encouraging, bullying, blackmailing, I'm not sure where on that spectrum, that's what Joe Unwin was doing and sort of made it happen. Yeah, I still can't kind of get used to the fact that it's out there.
And has it whetted your appetite to do more books? Or
I think scripts are so much easier, to be honest. I mean, I don't feel I could write a novel because I hate describing things. I just find it too much of a responsibility, and I don't know enough adjectives. I even on scripts, I'm people always complain I don't do enough stage directions. So, I'm not sure. But I don't know if you found this, like when you do a script, you get a million notes from a million people and you do endless drafts. And with a book, when Joe wrestled it out of my grip, I sort of thought, oh, well, maybe when I've sort of completely changed the beginning and rewritten the middle and then done a different end and, you know, it'll be all right. But they were just like, okay, thanks, yeah, print. And you're like, no, wait, I need to work on it for another 10,000 drafts. But it's not like
that. Yeah, it is weird. It isn't really, there's not the end. I found that with definitely my book, the How Not to Grow Up. I kind of really thought, oh, you know, he'll come back with loads of stuff. I've really just scribbled this down. And he came back with like four or five main things, like about just ordering. And then that was, and I was going, what, you're just going to put out the rest of that stuff? But it is, you know, you've got, the more you do, the more you kind of get, you get a little bit better, but the more you kind of find the way of doing it, I think. But yeah, it is, it's a very, but I sort of like that. I like the being left alone and finding that rather than with TV scripts. I mean, but also with TV scripts, you have to please so many people. Yeah. With a book, you know, if someone says they want to do it, then that's enough.
Yeah. Really.
It doesn't have to, and then it happens.
Yeah.
Whereas what I found frustrating with script writing, which I also love, but I've just, you know, had so few scripts actually made, is exactly that you put your heart and soul into something and then it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And then that's just the worst thing. Yeah. So it's very hard. If you're not having success after success, it's very hard to put yourself through that again. And I know you've experienced both sides of the coin on that. I know that you've had your years of struggling through before. Is it still if you come up with a script idea, is it still as hard to pitch it now, or do people go, okay, we'll do it straight away?
No, it's still I find it's really hard. I mean, it's so different in this country and America. In this country, you sort of shuffle into a room and mumble and apologize while someone with folded arms glares at you. And then in America, they kind of, you know, want you to sort of come in and do the sort of act out the whole thing, which is terrifying. But it doesn't get any easier, and I still get as emotionally involved, and still it's funny actually with Succession, which for the first kind of season or two, you know, no one was really watching. I think it was lockdown that made people watch it, and it was interesting because people sort of now have decided it was an instant success, which it wasn't at all. And in the first season, I wrote this episode set on Thanksgiving, and I got such. So, as you know, certainly at the beginning, Succession was written by largely by a sort of group of shambolic, scruffy British comedy writers. And there was some sort of trepidation felt in some quarters about whether we could pull off a sort of high-end, glossy American drama. And
yeah,
we absolutely couldn't in some ways, because we had no idea what it was like to be rich. And we were just thrilled that HBO were paying for our Pret sandwiches. And so they had to get this rich consultant on to tell us what it was like. And I'd written this episode set on Thanksgiving, and I had a sort of, well, first of all, I had someone wearing a coat, and the guy was like, rich people don't wear coats, they go from their car to their jet to their building, you know, their shoes don't touch ground, it's always carpet. And and then I'd written in this Thanksgiving episode that Marcia, Logan's wife, sort of said, right, you know, it's lunchtime, I've made turkey. And they were like, oh my God, you know, she wouldn't know where the kitchen was, she wouldn't deign to talk about turkey. And so then I did a rewrite and sort of thought, right, you know, concentrate this time. So I sort of put maids in maids uniforms as sort of serving turkey. And then he was like, oh my God, you know, where did you get the idea that there are maids in maids uniforms? And I was sort of saying, I don't know, maybe porn or racist Tom and Jerry cartoons. I don't know. But yeah, apparently it's very handsome young men in chinos and polo shirts to do that.
Well, presumably you're so successful now that you have all that those things. I presume you fly everywhere by helicopter now.
Exactly. Actually, that's the actors all had to be taught not to duck as they got in and out of the helicopter, because rich right. people don't duck.
But it's, you know, it's extraordinary, but it's such a brilliant series. I'm very, you know, and it is great to see all these people who won the Light Entertainment Corridor, as well as some other people, doing so well and being in Hollywood. And, you know, Peter Bainham was always yes. my, you know, is the, from what he from going for that little groveling man eating trifles he was making in his mouth to being a Hollywood superstar. It's kind of, you know, you're never going to, you couldn't have guessed. It'd be interesting to go back and look. You would never have, I mean, you wouldn't have really thought any of those people were going to be successful.
I know. I remember actually being in the flat you shared with Peter Bainham.
Oh, yes.
I think we were on a date. I don't know if he realised it, but I did. and you came back sort of in the middle of it and really embarrassed us both.
I don't remember.
Happy memories.
I should remember, because Pete didn't have many girls back. So I should remember. But I sadly don't remember. I was mainly drunk throughout the
90s.
I don't remember very much, which made me lucky. I mean, you know, so do you think writers? I mean, I always, you know, writers are so much. I mean, they're literally the genesis of all sort of these dramas and TV, and they get very little recognition for that. Does that, I mean, it probably doesn't bother you. Does it bother you? I don't know. Do you feel like none of this would happen without you?
No, I mean, it's weird. Over here, we certainly get treated with no respect and utter disdain and sort of ignored and like a sort of unpleasant sort of thing that has to happen, you know, and the scripts are sort of snatched from us and then they never want to see us again. But in America, you get treated with total respect, and it's so yes. unnerving and unsettling. It's really odd. So yeah, they have a completely different, and they want you on set and they want to know what you think and they want, you know, it's bizarre.
So, why have you come back? You're home now, I'm presuming. Are you back in the UK now? Why have you come back? Why aren't you living in America?
Well, you know, this is where I live. We write Succession here, and we wrote most of Veep here, and obviously Thick of It. Yeah. So, yeah, I do like it there. It's fun to go there and visit. But yeah, this is where my home is and my family. So,
yes. Well, you haven't changed, which is good to see. I mean, you know, you haven't become affected, I mean, by your
total monster. I'm just disguising it.
Well, look, the book is absolutely terrific. Everyone should read it. And I think it's very honest about yourself. If anything, you're too down on yourself, I think. But that's why you are what you are. It's sort of slightly upsetting to realise as a writer that you need to have this different way of looking at the world for it to work out. It's what makes it exciting. But I think, you know, it does. I'm very glad that you've got through the issues that the book was dealing with. I think maybe as a stand-up comedian, I was saying this in the last week's show, is that you know, you end up writing quite personally about yourself more than you do as a writer.
Definitely.
So I've always found it like so helpful to get through whatever the problem is that I'm going through, to write comedy about it and then go, oh, and a year later you go, oh yeah, that was very therapeutic. So I kind of completely get why this writing this book would have helped. And it's great that, you know, and it's great that it makes it a great book as well, because it starts and finishes in the same place. Yeah. and it's worked as a result of you doing it.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you a new thing that I'm going to ask in each episode is, are there any books that you would recommend that you haven't written that you're reading at the moment?
Yes, I'm reading Sorrow and Bliss by Meg Mason, which is absolutely brilliant. Have you heard of that one?
I haven't. I don't know much about books. Okay. I don't know why I'm doing a book podcast. I hardly ever read novels. Is that a novel?
It is. Yeah, it's really good. Yeah. It's really funny. Yeah. I recently read My Sister, the Serial Killer, which is also really funny and really brilliant. And I just started this book called, I think it's called Hell of a Book by an American writer, which is great. And I've only just started it, but it seems to be about a writer who's on a book tour and can't remember what his book's about, which seemed like a really good idea.
That sounds brilliant.
They're all good.
Great. All right. I'll check those out. I'll check all of those out.
Fantastic.
Thank you very much, Georgia. Lovely to see you again. Thank you to Chris Evans for producing and all of our work and getting us through some terrible technical difficulties at the start of this. Hopefully it's all been okay. Good luck with everything.
Thanks, Richard.
My Mess is a Bit of a Life. I've held it up to the camera, realizing that A, it's an audio podcast, and B, my camera isn't working. But I'm holding it up now. Thanks, Georgia.
Thank you so much.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks very much for listening to the podcast. Go to GoFasterStripe.com for fantastic downloads and books, and to join the Go Faster Stripe Club and get loads of stuff from really interesting comedians. Help little Chris Evans knock that one out. That would be lovely. All right, richardherring.com for all my gigs. Hope to see you at a gig. Come and say hi after if you've enjoyed these podcasts. Don't come if you haven't enjoyed them and say you haven't enjoyed them. It'll make me feel sad.